It's great to see you. So SAO is the South African Astronomical Observatory, and SARAO is the South African Radio Astronomical Observatory, which is the base for the SKA in South Africa. So yeah, thanks so much. I apologize upfront. My slides are not very good. Things have been so crazy that I have not had a chance to put as much effort into these slides as I normally would. Please do stop me and so Latham, if you can just monitor chats and if questions come up, please just interrupt. I think that's
Okay.
always much more fun. So this work is in collaboration with a bunch of people at SARAO. So SARAO, the SKA, has been tasked with managing the National Ventilator Project, which is in a drive to emergency build a large number of non-invasive ventilators. And so the data science team that I lead there has been tasked with sort of making estimates for the likely numbers. And I'll discuss some of that. All right, let's jump right in. it's very bizarre to try and give an introduction to a subject that basically everyone's an expert on, at least experientially, if not on the details. This is just a plot from a few days ago of the number of new cases per day and the number of daily deaths. And if I look back, this is all China in the early days where, we were following it very early on, and of course things have changed a lot. In South Africa, this is the situation on a log plot. Blue is the number of cases, yellow is the number of deaths, and we can see a lot of things out of this. The first is that South Africa is perfectly, almost perfectly exponential, both in the number of cases and in the number of deaths, but the deaths are rising faster than the number of cases, which I think is just an artifact of testing. We are not testing fast enough to stay up with the number of deaths. But the big question then becomes, well, when is this going to break, if it's going to break? So that gives a kind of local context to our discussion. Having worked on dark energy, dark matter, cosmology, we're used to mysterious kind of subjects, but COVID is a fascinating disease. There's so many mysteries. Where did it originate? Is it natural, man-made? When did it start circulating? How long are people infectious for? Ironically, we don't actually know the answer to that yet. Does a positive PCR test indicate infectiousness and the converse? Are sicker people more infectious than mild cases? They are contradictory studies. What are the important factors in the spread? Obviously, this is critical. Is climate a major factor? Is blood type? Is, BCG vaccinations? Do prior vaccinations provide some immunity? What's the main transmission route? So, corollary is how effective are masks? Are asymptomatic people very infectious or not? Is there more than one strain of the virus, fundamentally different strain with different mortality rates, etc., circulating? Are most infections spread by a few people, the so-called super spreaders? And then on the medical side, which of course I'm not qualified to talk about at all, is why does this disease seem to affect so many systems in the body? What are the long-term effects and how long does it take to recover? What fraction of people who recover develop antibodies and therefore some sort of immunity? How long does immunity last? Do some people already have partial immunity? And of course, the big question is, can a vaccine be developed? And how deadly is the virus actually? And how bad is it to have HIV? Because in South Africa, 8 million people roughly have HIV, a huge proportion. 15% or so of the population have HIV. So this is a really important question for South Africa. So I'm just going to discuss a few of these, just a kind of sampling, random sampling. When did it start circulating in humans? What are the long-term effects? What factors are important in the spread? How deadly is it, and how bad is it to have HIV? So, in other words, what are the projections for South Africa? So how long has it been circulating? Well, interestingly, it now appears that the first case in Paris was at least as early as December 27th, and maybe middle of December is possible. So that's quite interesting, given that, you know, the standard timeline is that it started circulating only in China in late November, early December. Then there's this very interesting preprint that came out just a couple of days ago claiming that it may have been circulating as early as August in China. And so I quite like this, although I can't really comment on how accurate it is. But what they did is they looked at the parking lots of the hospitals in Wuhan and just looked at the volume. And so up here on the top is the relative car volume for the major hospitals in China, along with some sort of regression. And you can see here's this dotted line is August. There's a definite uptick. And then there's a downtick when the lockdowns are imposed, starting around December. They also looked at Baidu search traffic. And in blue, you can see searches for coughs. And then in red, you can see searches for diarrhea. And on the 1st of August, or actually slightly before the 1st of August, there's this somewhat significant, I don't know how significant, uptick in diarrhea searches. So there's this idea that in some form, the virus may have been spreading much earlier than December. How about the question of how long does it take for?
Sorry, Bruce,
Yeah.
did they compare this with other hospitals? You said that the other ones were other hospitals.
Yeah, so these are all these hospitals up here, are all Hubei and Wuhan hospitals. So you can see they've gone back as far as early 2018. So there's not much comparison.
But the question is,
So
elsewhere in China, what was happening? Was there something
exactly, that would
related
be
to that?
interesting.
Okay.
And so a related question is, you know, is are these Baidu searches national or just in Wuhan? And I'm not sure. I think really I'm just putting this forward as a placeholder to the question, how do we know when, how long this has been circulating? It might have been circulating much longer worldwide, but there was you know, a mutation that happened sometime around August, September. You know, these are just interesting questions to
Yeah,
think.
absolutely.
You know, because we, like with dark energy, for example, we don't know which piece of critical information is the clue to unlocking the mysteries.
At least in this plot, it doesn't look like there was any excess compared to the previous year, right? It seems like it went down.
In the traffic of car volume, traffic,
Search volume.
search volume. Well, I think it's the diarrhea that's the important
Oh, I see.
point.
Okay. Not the.
So their point is like cough is a kind of normalizing baseline in some sense. It's
December 23rd, there's that peak there, really seems to stand out.
Yes, I think January the 23rd, which is this third one, is when they officially went into full lockdown. So then that is an interesting question. I guess this is when people become self-aware and start wondering about stuff, and you can't trust the searches, perhaps. Complex. You know, naively, I would have thought that if really the disease is spreading exponentially, I would have thought you would have things like this. It's a bit strange that it suddenly tapers off and it becomes constant if it's spreading exponentially. So, I mean, there are many questions. I would say that this is very tentative at the minimum, yeah, at the best.
I guess the other thing is the look elsewhere effect is like, why diarrhea? And I mean, how many other things did they look at?
Absolutely. I mean, that's very, very important point. Another very interesting thing just about how the disease manifests is that people who get the disease may have a mild case, as in they don't die or don't go to hospital. But what's becoming apparent is that even the mild cases have this very complex behavior, in which the viral load, for this is a schematic plot, the viral load that is shown in red can go up and down over many weeks. And so the body's inflammation can be very complex as well. And I, this is something I've been personally very interested in and noticed that people will describe how the symptoms will vary every week. So some, you know, the range of symptoms can be very high. So, you know, this is a kind of thing, a very interesting thing from the medical point of view.
If I'm not wrong, fluctuating viral load like that was an important sign in HIV, that there was a very active fight going on between the immune system and the virus.
Absolutely. And you make a good point. There are quite a few parallels to HIV. And of course that's concerning because we still don't have a vaccine for HIV. So, you know, the worst case is that, you know, it may be hard to build an effective vaccine against COVID, which would be, you know, really dramatically bad, right? So, yeah.
I'm not sure how much to interrupt here. I see that there is some commentary going on, in the chat feed. Basically, three people have commented skeptically about the previous slide. I don't know whether any of you want to say anything in particular or...
this one.
It may be the more efficient thing is to... Well, I guess this goes against normal Zoom etiquette, but it always has seemed to me that maybe if you want to make a comment in the talk, just go ahead and turn on your mic and make a comment like you would in an ordinary seminar.
I can comment on that very, very quickly.
Go for it.
So there was some follow up to that study, and I have no idea how robust it was. So that diarrhea search result apparently was for symptoms of diarrhea, not diarrhea. If you look just for diarrhea, there was a decrease in the same period. So that was one of the criticisms. The other one was just that the line of sight to the parking lots from these satellite images is partially blocked. So it's kind of dealing with incomplete information, according to the BBC article.
Nice.
That's my only source there.
Absolutely.
I mean, we are all scientists here, right? So you can present whatever data showing some correlation with something, but there's no solid background here. And there's even no falsifiability you can test or not.
Mm-hmm. Right.
Right? You can draw whatever kind of supportive or kind of counter evidence to say something. Mm-hmm. And also here, right, just based on some search engine results or some hospital traffic, even for some hospital traffic, I mean, there's some evidence like some hospital, they build some new parking lots there. So there are more cars.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
There's an underground parking lot there that's obviously not a good car.
I think there's a difference between using data like this as a search for indications of phenomenon than to use them as tests of hypotheses. And I think Bruce is only doing the first.
Yeah, certainly I would, you know, there's no way in which I'm claiming this as any conclusive results. It's more for me, about trying to ask questions, like to unravel the mystery, because we have lots of contradictory evidence in many aspects of the disease, and so this is very much just in the spirit of challenging the standard narrative, not in any way other than just to keep our minds open. So yeah, I'm definitely not going to die on this hill for for sure. This is really just a precursor of things that I found kind of interesting topics. So if everyone's okay, I'll actually move to the more core parts of the talk. So I think one of the key questions is, you know, how deadly is the disease really? And this is usually quantified through this thing called the infection fatality rate. It's just the probability of dying conditioned in a kind of Bayesian way on the fact that you got infected. And of course, it's an easy thing to write down, but hard to actually compute. And there are many common mistakes. The most common mistakes people is that they calculate a crude case fatality rate, which is crude in the sense that they take a case fatality rate in the sense that they divide the number of deaths by the number of cases of actual positive tests. So that's a CFR, and crude in the sense that they do it at a given time. So for Italy, if you did that today, you would say, well, there have been 34,000 deaths and 237,000 infections. Crude case fatality rate is 14%. Oh my God, everyone's going to die. Well, of course, this is completely wrong for several reasons. The first case is, of course, we're missing most of the cases. So this is a bit like Marmquist bias in astronomy. If you look out at the universe, you see the brightest objects and you miss the faint objects. Here, the cases tend to reflect the most severe cases and not the milder asymptomatic ones. A second problem, of course, is that there's a delay to deaths. So on average, it takes people about 14 days to die. So of course, that will actually push up your estimate, because if you waited for 2 weeks, this 34,000 deaths will increase, and so you'll increase the deaths. Of course, the other problem is that we're missing deaths altogether. You know, people who never get tested and who die, for example, old age homes, will not be counted. And that again will mean that the true IFR is actually higher. And then of course, fundamentally, there's a kind of gauge dependence here, because what is an IFR? It's an average, but it's an average over what? Which population? We know that the probability of dying is very age dependent and very comorbid dependent. So even if you infected every single person in Canada and you calculated an IFR, you wouldn't be able to apply that to a very different country with a very different age dependence. So it's not even really clear what we mean when we talk about an IFR. So it's a bit like in internal inflation, when you take different slices and you calculate averages, what do you actually mean? So let's go through a couple of those. The missing cases, well, of course, the disease is very clever in a sense, because a significant fraction of people have almost no symptoms. And so that makes it very hard to stop the spread of the disease. What is the fraction of asymptomatic cases? Well, we don't know for sure. It's somewhere definitely between, I think, 10 and 80%. But is it, or maybe even 90%, is it 50% or 70%? Or does the asymptomatic fraction correlate with something else? For example, in the Diamond Princess study, they found that young people had a low asymptomatic fraction and old people had a high asymptomatic fraction. So the older people were the ones who had the more severe symptoms when they showed symptoms, but they had the higher asymptomatic fraction. I mean, that would make it very difficult to make projections, right? If the asymptomatic fraction correlates with age or blood type or something like that. To make it even more complicated, and this is where perhaps astronomers and physicists can help, you know, we know that PCR testing is limited, both in the fact that we can't test everyone and with the fact that the false negative rate is a strong function of when you test people. So for example, if we go back to this schematic plot, the red curve is the viral load schematically. If you happen to test people in the trough, you have a much higher chance of a false negative. So it's quite hard to statistically account for these false negative rates, especially since we don't know. And, you know, even beyond this, there's still incredible complexities in the disease. I mean, Belgium and Qatar are lovely examples. So Belgium today has 60,000 positive cases, 9,500 deaths. Qatar has 82,000 cases and only 80 deaths. So their case fatality rates differ by 100, and yet their testing protocols are actually pretty similar. Belgium tests about 90,000 people per million, Qatar 107,000. So this isn't being driven just by, oh, Qatar is testing many more people. So there is Qatar is a little bit younger, but not hugely younger than Belgium. So, you know, what's going on here? So I think it's a very interesting problem. So you can take the crude case fatality rate, and this plot is probably about a month old, and you can plot it against number of tests per million. And you do see that this is an exponential, you know, log plot. you can do see that there's some general correlation that the more you test, the lower the case fatality rate becomes. And so the real question would be, well, if you tested everyone, what would the fatality rate end up with? And I think that's a key question.
Bruce, I see Lee has his hand up.
Yes, sure. Thanks, Lee.
Yes, just a comment. Talking to virologists, a viral disease that is asymptomatic or has very low symptoms is characteristic of a virus that's been with human beings, whatever species it is, for a long time. So it's evolved and knows how to live in us without disturbing us. And that seems to conflict with the narrative that it came from the bats through one other carrier, perhaps, just to us now.
Very interesting, yeah. You know, I'm not a virologist, so I can't really comment, but I did notice a paper that proposed that about up to perhaps 40 to 60% of humans may have partial immunity because of exposure to the other coronaviruses, you know, the ones that are not particularly dangerous. So it could be that that's an element of this puzzle as well, that some people effectively have very mild symptoms because they had partial immunity from previous exposure. Yeah. So yeah, it just adds to the mystery of this disease. So for example, that could be another element of the IFR question. If you've had previous exposure to other coronaviruses, you might have one fatality rate. And if you haven't, you might have another. Because it seems also clear that it's the body that often attacks itself in these cytokine storms that often lead to death. So it's almost like people end up sort of killing themselves at some level. Anyway, you know, I can't comment because this is definitely not my field. But yeah, definitely more grist to the uncertainty mill. One thing, of course, people, and this narrative has somewhat disappeared, but certainly 6 weeks ago, there were lots of people claiming that maybe COVID-19 is just like the flu in terms of its fatality rate. You know, we don't actually know what the influenza IFR is because, of course, we have the same problem. We don't know what the true number of infections are. But people were saying, well, maybe it just spreads much faster than the flu. And so you get all of the flus, you know, 500,000 people a year might die of flu. But if you stuck them all into the ICU at the same time, it would look like an absolute Armageddon. So I think this was a very interesting problem. And so what I did was I did a very simple thing and just say, okay, well, can we put a lower bound on the IFR for COVID-19 that's and compare it to this typical number that is quoted for flu, 0.1%. And actually, you can do that. You just assume that everyone in a region has been infected. If the problem is that you don't know how many infections there are, just assume everyone is infected. Now, of course, if you do that for the whole world, you get a lower bound on COVID IFR that's not useful. But if you limit yourself to New York City, Lombardy, and Madrid, you actually get quite an interesting result. This is an updated number. I don't know. This is probably about 10 days old. But there had been 10 days or so ago about 46,000 deaths. And there were 25 million people. So right there, you can prove that the average IFR in those 25 million people was more than 0.18%. But of course, the caveat is all three of those scenarios were in healthcare systems that were overwhelmed. So in at least what we can show is that in overwhelmed healthcare systems, the average IFR is at least twice as bad as the normal flu number.
Bruce, I think I asked the question over email on this as well. Where do you draw the line? I mean, where the NYC ends? Because is that kind of arbitrary?
Yes, I mean, absolutely. The way I defined it is that I literally just took the New York City numbers. You know, so effectively that defines my boundary. They will have some internal definition for that. So of course, one possibility is, you know, when we say that, there are 8.4 million people living in New York City, A, they don't know that, that's an estimate. And B, the hope is, the assumption is that the 21,000 people who've died are coming from that 8.4 million. So for example, one way that this could be wrong is if a lot of people from outside of New York City, when they got sick, went to New York City hospitals for treatment, then you would have effectively an influx of people who were much more likely to die. Mm-hmm. I actually think it's more likely to be the other way, right? Because the hospitals were overwhelmed, I would have thought people who started to get sick might flee to avoid having to go to a place where there were no ICU beds. But it is a caveat. It's a valid caveat. Yeah. You can, of course, if you want, go and look at things like the Bronx, where you would get even higher IFRs, because I think the death rate there was much more severe. It doesn't change it by more than a factor of 20% or something, though. But So, of course, we know that 100% of people weren't infected. And in fact, we now have serological studies which try to estimate how many people were actually infected. And in Spain, I think Madrid was actually about 11%, if I remember rightly, maybe a slightly higher. In New York City, numbers around 20%. So in fact, it's probable that we have to multiply this probably by around a factor of 5. In Wuhan, they recently, did everybody very impressively. And for example, in Spain, they said, well, on average, we're seeing about 5% of the population being infected. So, Spain has 289,000 confirmed positives. 5% of the Spanish population is about 2.3 million. So that suggests that we're missing about 90% of the infections. And so that suggests that the IFR is somewhere broadly between 0.5 to 1.3 on average. But of course, this doesn't account for the missing deaths. So that could augment the IFR by 30, 40, 50%. So, it's not 0.2%, I think is the answer. I was hoping that when they did serological studies that this would be, 20%. So the fact that it's coming back a little bit low either means the serological studies are missing people, which is possible. Perhaps people are not developing antibodies. But do we care if someone doesn't develop antibodies and is therefore missed in a serological study, do we care? Does that really help us? Does that affect the IFR? These are some subtle questions that need to be, that we need more study on, I would say.
It's just studies of antibodies. Apparently, it's very time dependent. If you don't do it at the right time, and there are like two kind of antibodies that are developing, you might miss. Mm.
IgG, IgM. The question about this is where it comes towards the question of immunity. So I think there's two things. There's one about what is the IFR, and the other is about herd immunity. Will these things actually convey immunity in the future? So yeah, I think we still have to wait to see the answer to that. Just to note that these IFRs that we're getting on the previous slide are consistent with what came out from the Diamond Princess. Here is the average fatality rate that I derived from the Diamond Princess, assuming the Chinese CDC age dependent, how the CFR ramps up with age, this is what you would end up from Diamond Princess. So I think somewhere between a half and one is probably a reasonable guess. So just in the context of South Africa, we want to know how many people we should expect to die in South Africa. And I should just say, the problem for South Africa is that South Africa acted extremely proactively. On the 27th of...
Bruce, just to try, before you move on to the next topic. I mean, there is this also question of how much exposure you get. That you kind of assuming that, okay, so there's the infection is just one event and everyone who gets infected, there's some probability that would die. But there's also the other possibility is that the more you expect, the more likely you are to actually develop more severe symptoms and die, right?
Absolutely. And I think that does make sense, right? If you're trying to overwhelm someone, having a massive influx at the early time would probably be more likely. I mean, you wouldn't invade a country one soldier a day, right? You know, that clearly would fail as an invasion strategy. Right. So I think, you know, I can't comment on it at all, but at least it sounds plausible that would have an effect.
But then, I mean, we're not talking about a single number, but rather, I mean, a distribution of IFRs, depending on, I guess how sudden the exposure is, or, yeah.
I would say that is basically the game we're trying to play. And it goes back to being kind of similar to dark energy. We can measure very few things. The data is very poor quality and it's contradictory. And we could build a model with everything included, right? Spatial dependence, partial susceptibility, all of these things. We'll end up with a model of 20,000 parameters and we won't be able to measure anything. So the real question is, how do we do model selection to rule out these very different models with very crappy data and data that's contradictory and taken in under very inhomogeneous conditions? Absolutely. So I think that's the challenge we face. And it's very similar to cosmology, right?
Yeah.
All right. So naively in South Africa, if you wanted to make predictions, and I'll just, I don't know how to do this. You can close your eyes for a few seconds while I do this, is if we go back to this plot, South Africa, you can see this kink here on the 27th of March. That was the day the South Africa went into full lockdown. We went straight to the maximum lockdown we could have. You were not allowed out of the house except for food and to go to the hospital. No exercise, nothing. That was maximal lockdown, one of the most severe. And you can see all it did was stop people from testing, basically, because there was no 2-week delay to see the impact of the lockdown. It happened immediately. And we are still growing exponentially. So basically, South Africa took its best shot at crushing the virus and failed. So for us, the problem is there's nothing more for us. We cannot do anything. We're not like Sweden, who chose to do some intermediate space. We took this incredibly tough action when we only had 1,000 cases and it didn't work. So, you know, now, you know, we have to just sit and go and ask, well, how many people are going to die? So part of our problem, of course, well, one good thing is that South Africa has very young population. Only 5% of South Africans are over 65. So if we look at this is the Chinese CDC case fatality rate versus age, this bodes very well for South Africa. Here's an example of the relative age distribution of South Africa compared to Holland, for example. So South African females in black, you can see they drop off very fast with age. Holland has this big older population. And you can do this for the whole world. And so this is actually a map of the average effective CFR for the whole world. Up here is Japan, and then Italy is second, and then I think Greece or something. And you can see down here is a lot of Africa and the third world. So, you know, in principle, this shouldn't hit the third world very heavily. The problem, of course, is that, well, let me just make a comment that you can compute the effective CFRs by region using the Chinese CDC CFR as if it were an IFR. So these numbers are exaggeratedly high, but for Africa, you can see that it's roughly 4 times lower than what it was in China. So in principle, this is very good. The problem is comorbid conditions. So one of the disturbing things that came out already, you know, in January and February, was this strong comorbid condition phenomenon, including hypertension, high blood pressure, which of course is very common around the world. So in South Africa, we, as I said, is we have 8 million people living with HIV, 15% highest prevalence in the world. We also have very high hypertension, diabetes, malnutrition, obesity, ironically, malnutrition and obesity, and one of the highest tuberculosis rates in the world. So the question is, well, what is this going to do to the average IFR for South Africa? And we just don't know. What we now have 1,000 people who've died in the Western Cape around Cape Town. And this is a analysis of comorbidities as a function of age. And you know, maybe draw your attention to red. The red bar is HIV. The yellow bar is hypertension. And you can see that for young people, 20 to 40, 40 to 50, HIV is a more prevalent, more common comorbid condition than hypertension, even though hypertension is probably more common than HIV in young people. Once you get to 50 and above, hypertension really takes off and HIV progressively becomes less common. But part of that is that, of course, HIV is much less common in older people, partly because 250,000 people a year died from HIV in South Africa in for several years in the early 2000s. You know, South Africa has had a really shameful policy regarding HIV. There was a lot of HIV denialism under Thabo Mbeki. And so the estimates are that 250,000 people died a year for several years. And so there just aren't people who are old with HIV because mostly they all died. So it's quite difficult to control for the prevalence of HIV as a function of age. But so we don't know what the IFR is going to be in South Africa. The flip side question is, well, how many people do we expect to be infected? Forgive me, I'm not sure if everyone's familiar with this, but I'll just go through it. The key epidemiological models typically focus on these quantities, R0 and RT, the reproductive numbers. The R0 is a reproductive number at time zero, basically when no one knows that it's spreading, when the disease is sort of under the radar. And estimates for COVID-19 are that it's somewhere between 2 and 6. And then RT is just that quantity, that reproductive number. So I didn't explain what it is. If I'm infected, how many people do I infect on average before I no longer am infectious? And so RT is just that number as a function of time. And there's two factors to that. One is, of course, is if I isolate or if we isolate, then I stop infecting people. And then, of course, as the number of people who are infected gets large, nonlinear effects just automatically switch off the exponential growth. And what's kind of neat is that in the simple models, you can predict the final population who will be infected as a function of R naught. And it goes from basically zero when R is one, because you don't have any exponential growth if R is one, and goes asymptotes up to 100% if you, as you increase R. And so the blue curves, the blue dots are just the results of actually simulating a compartmental model. And so one question is, well, this is R naught. What if RT is varying with time and you've got some curve that's varying? Is there a simple way to predict the final attack rate based on a varying RT? And so this is an analogy again with dark energy. You know, if dark energy equation of state is varying with time, we learned how to predict kind of observable consequences. And so that would be quite a nice little project for somebody to work on. It's probably been solved somewhere in the literature, but I haven't seen it. There have been estimates of what the interventions have done to RT for all of the European countries. This was an early imperial report. The initial analysis was that RT was somewhere between 3 and 4, 50 and 95% confidence. Then the different types of interventions, school closure, social distancing, and then eventually full lockdown, brought it below one. And once you're below one, then the number of daily cases start to drop. That's almost the definition. But I just want to make a point. If you simulate these models, and this goes back to that attack rate graph, in this bottom curve is a model in, you know, of South Africa in which RT is 1.05 for all time. You can see you just get this very slow exponential spread. And after 2 years, so on the bottom is days, starting at day zero, and you end up with 10,000 deaths. And then we have three scenarios in which you start off at 1.05, and then after 6 months, 12 months, or 18 months, you transition to RT of 2. And what you see is you just get attracted to essentially what ends up being like 470,000 deaths. So this is the depressing plot, right? It means you could, for 18 months, you could live in complete lockdown and do incredibly well at slowing the spread of the disease. And then you decide, okay, it's time to open up. And in these models, you would still have 500,000 deaths, the same as you would have had if you had just stopped lockdown after 6 months. So yeah, that's pretty depressing. But of course, with this caveat that, you know, George Box's comment that all models are wrong, but some are useful. So the real question is, are these models useful? And how would we know if they are not useful? How do we know if these results are true of the real world?
Sorry, why does it, a question about that plot, why does it plateau again? Is that because herd immunity is kicking in or because of something else?
Yeah, exactly. So for RT of 2, you essentially go back to this. You end up and say, okay, we end up for R is 80% of the population gets infected. And so for an IFR, you know, for an IFR of 1%, 80% of South Africa is 48 million. So 1% is 480,000. So that's basically what it's saying. And, you know, this makes perfect sense, right? The analogy I give is, let's imagine that I've decided I'm going to kill myself at midnight tonight. And then at midnight, you hear that I'm going to shoot myself. So you give me a call and we chat for 45 minutes and you try and convince me not to kill myself. And I say, no. And then at 12:30, I put the phone down and shoot myself. That 45 minutes, all it did was delay essentially the identical thing, right? So essentially there's a kind of time translation invariance here. It doesn't matter when you start. What matters is you now have a phase where RT is 2, and that's what happens, right? So, you know, the problem for third world countries is, and also for countries that don't eradicate the disease, is what has all of this work been for? You know, and there's many answers to that, but this is definitely something that we're going to have to struggle with. Some part of me feels like, well, you should just implement the strategy that you can sustain for an arbitrarily long period of time with the lowest value of RT. So there's no point having a very low value of RT if you can't sustain it arbitrarily long at some level.
So Bruce,
if the models are true.
I just have a comment on that is, I don't think that's true. I think the one conclusion is that the very low value of RT is not good. And you need like some intermediate value of RT so that you don't suddenly kind of have an all outbreak. You just kind of slowly, and that people will die, but at least not as many as they do if you just have an exponential, I mean, full blown exponential growth.
I think that's right. You don't want to just let go completely. You know, this curve shows that letting go is stupid. So the point is, what you don't want to do is try and hold your breath.
That's
and
right.
Then like suddenly you have to inhale because that's disastrous. You want to, whatever you do, you want to be okay that you want to be happy with sustaining it for as long as it takes. Yeah. Mm-hmm. So I think that is related to your point. But of course, what is the exact optimal choice is a completely unsolved optimization problem. I'd love to chat to people about it because of course there are lots of consequences, economic consequences. But for example, in South Africa, we know that lockdown is killing people. Okay, it's also saving lives. We've had many fewer deaths due to flu in children because they're washing their hands much more. So hygiene has gone up. So it's actually saving deaths, but we're also missing roughly 2,000 new tuberculosis infections a month. And the same with HIV. So those people are not getting treatment. So we will have a lot of indirect deaths because of the lockdown. So, you know, this is a very complicated problem in terms of what does an optimal strategy look like. Yes, go ahead.
Bruce, is there any evidence that absent of a real antiviral drug or a vaccine, the doctors and the nurses still may be getting much better at seeing people through the difficult times with the infection, and many more surviving just due to the increased craft and skill of the hospitals and the doctors and the nurses?
Yeah, I mean, I think there's two elements to that. The first is just helping the doctors not get infected, right? Because if you look at the original statistics from Wuhan, you know, the case fatality rate for doctors, for healthcare workers, was 5%, if I remember rightly, in the first few weeks, and that rapidly dropped. So medical staff learning how to not get infected is part of that craft, right? Because, so that's the first thing, because we know that the virus spreading in hospitals is also a huge problem. So I think that is a component. And I think definitely there's a lot of insights, I can't really talk to it, but I see a lot of discussion. For example, a simple thing of proning, you know, lying on your stomach seems to be very effective at helping to keep patients out of ICU. And there's simple physics about that, is about how do you get the oxygen into the blood when oxygen is in short supply? Well, lying on your stomach does a much better job of that. And that's something that you can even just teach people who are quarantining at home, lie on your stomach and breathe from your stomach. That's a simple example. So I think that's definitely true. And of course, that is not being included in these simulations. So you could try to include that by saying, okay, well, we should expect the IFR to go down as we share knowledge around the world on how to deal with the disease. Plus the probability of a successful antiviral treatment or a vaccine goes up. So the expected future deaths in these three scenarios would not be the same on average because of that time-dependent effect. So hanging on later does have some added value. So just in terms of this thing about can we trust these models, these models that I presented are compartmental models in which you have a mean field, but we know that society is not like that. We know that there's a small number of people who are highly connected and who will have R's much bigger than the average R naught, in the sense that they go and they meet a huge number of people. Like, for example, pastors who give sermons very often and who shake hundreds of people's hands a week, they are not going to infect two people on average. They're going to infect a large number of people. And so you could ask, won't this change our mean field predictions a great deal? And I think this is actually a very similar problem to the averaging or the back reaction problem in cosmology. In cosmology, we ask, the real universe is inhomogeneous, but we fit it with some spatially isotropic and homogeneous model, a Robertson-Walker model, and then what omega matter should we use? What omega lambda, what cosmological parameters should we be using? Are those parameters the ones we get from just computing the average amount of dark matter, for example? Or should we be actually changing the equations of motion to account explicitly for the back reaction effect? And I think there's a very similar question here, and I don't know the answer. And in particular, can we trust any of these models actually, or are they completely wrong? Yeah, and so some people are saying, yeah, they're completely wrong. I think that's a very interesting question. And so, and I know Niyash is, for example, has been working on this, is it possible that actually R naught is 3 or 2, so we should expect 80% of people to need to be infected before we hit herd immunity, but could it be that these inhomogeneous network effects actually mean that herd immunity would kick in at 20%? Yeah, so there's a question, could it already have kicked in places like Spain, Italy, Sweden, etc.? So, you know, one way to ask that is, well, if that is the case, then when countries like Spain and Italy open up, we should not expect to see a second wave. And so here is Italy. Italy daily cases, Italy opened up more or less on the 18th of May. So we should allow 10 days to 2 weeks for the effects of that to propagate through, because there's roughly 5 days of incubation and then 5 days of 5 days to develop serious symptoms. But we don't really see any evidence for a second wave. I mean, so that's interesting and slightly strange. Of course, it is turning to summer, so it could be that. What about Iran, though? In Iran, we see definite evidence of something like a second wave, but it's complicated, right? It's not trivial. So I find this quite confusing personally. So that I think the jury is somewhat out. Evidence that it isn't herd immunity kicking in can be extracted, though. This is from this blog post, a comparison of Spain and New York City. And the point was that Spain and New York City had roughly comparable cases up to the 21st of March, I think. There were about 5,000 cases. Spain went into lockdown on the 15th of March. New York waited 2 weeks. One week, sorry. That looks like the 23rd of March against the 5th, so 8 days. So it looks like New York waited 8 days. And then you can't really, it's not great. That's the Spanish curve. You can see it starts to go down here. And then in both cases, exactly 2 weeks after the lockdown, the cases peaked and then started going down. Now, the population of New York and Spain are completely different. So if it really was herd immunity that was driving this, I would not have expected the delay to be 2 weeks in both cases. So for me, this suggests that really, at least in terms of New York and Spain, it really was the interventions, the lockdowns that caused the drop in the cases. And in fact, if you look at the world cases, you can see we had this exponential growth up until about the 3rd of April, and then we have the second phase. There's a similar thing in there's a two-week delay in terms of deaths. The whole world sort of went into lockdown at the beginning of April. You know, there was this. So for me, the fact that there's this very sharp transition in the world cases, again, also suggests that it was the fact that the world went into lockdown roughly around the same time. It's not conclusive, of course, but for me, I think this just reflects, yeah, there's some real subtleties around this disease, some complications. So how should we make projections for South Africa? There have been three or four projections saying that South Africa will not have more than 60,000 deaths in total. Some of them saying it's probably only 10,000 deaths. And what those people did is that they would draw some RT curve and they would say, this is what's going to happen. And I just think that's kind of insane. So what we did is we said, okay, well, let's sample from some sort of allowed space of RT curves. And of course, that is very prior dependent. But this is typically what we would do. We would have a number of essentially phase transitions in the value of RT over time, some of them quite optimistic, some of them quite pessimistic. You know, for example, if winter is really going to make things bad, okay, then RT should be high. If quarantining is effective, okay, then we could have RT be low. And in fact, this is what 2,000 of these curves look like in our ensemble. Is this realistic? I have no idea. Yeah. But at least it gives us a range of kind of optimistic to pessimistic scenarios over time. And so for these 2000 curves, the white line is the median value, and then 68 and 95% limits. These are our results. So bottom right is the total number of cases, including asymptomatic, including untested. And day zero is the 1st of April. Okay. So we are somewhere around here, day 70, maybe somewhere around days. And the white line is the median number of cases. So light blue is the number of people in hospital. Orange is the number of people in the critical state in ICU. And then here in black is the number of fatalities. And you can see that we have a few scenarios where you end up with just a few thousand deaths. The median is about 140,000. And then we have some cases that go up to 700,000, unfortunately. And this black line snaking up is the actual number of deaths in South Africa. So you can see that most of our models are currently under predicting the observed deaths. Unfortunately, I've moved this plot. This black line was supposed to be at 4,000. It's over here. This is the number of ICU beds that we have available. And you can see that our peak predictions in many of our models go up to 80,000 people in critical. And so modeling that ICU overwhelm is really very important. I just want to stop and check if there are any questions. I feel like I've been talking for long. One of the hard things about Zoom is that there's no audience feedback, so I can't actually tell if everyone's basically asleep.
I can actually maybe make another comment that, I mean, there are, I guess, millions of cases across the board, and then hundreds of thousands of deaths. So there are measurements of RT and how, I mean, you can basically correlate it with all the sorts of measures of, I guess, demographics and then population mobility and even the death fraction. Mm. And I think these are all, you don't have to rely on kind of some compartmental model. You could just measure these things.
Mm. Yeah, that's actually, and if I have time, and I see we are already out of time.
Yeah, okay.
We have done an analysis of the effects on, of this, but it's still hard.
Okay.
You know, I think the point is that a lot of this will depend, for example, on future government policy. So South Africa has 5 levels of lockdown. I don't know in Canada how many levels you do have, but that lockdown level, you know, could go up or down. We don't know what the government's.
But you see, the problem with this government policy is not very quantitative. It's just a statement. But you can measure, like, there is the levels of cell phone activity that you have access to. So those are actually quantifiable things. Let's see. If they have more or less cell phone activity in certain places, like in retail shops, does that positively correlate with RT or negatively correlate?
Yeah. I think that would be a very interesting thing to do. The problem is you need to forecast what the future contacts, you know, of people will be. And of course, that's very hard, especially in an inhomogeneous population. But, you know, I think that's the thing which drives this fundamental uncertainty. So I'm just going to, just comment briefly. We've modeled the ICU overwhelm. This is the histogram, the probability distribution of IFR values in our 2000 simulations. And you can see in red, the ICU overwhelm has a big impact on deaths. Just very quickly, we have done analysis for temperature and BCG vaccine. We found that BCG vaccine had no effect. We did see a positive effect of temperature, but these are the posterior distributions. The data is still consistent with no effect. The same with humidity, blood type, etc. So there were basically no statistically significant detections, except I will say one thing, positive rate. So the positive rate of tests, that was the one thing that correlated with RT values significantly. But that's probably not causative. It's probably a correlation. Places which were overwhelmed tended to have a high positive rate. So I don't think there was much.
This is RT from cases or RT from death?
From deaths. We focused on deaths because we didn't want, we thought that that would be less affected by testing. Mm-hmm. But still, there's some testing. Mm-hmm. So I think I'll call it quits there and just say, you know, our model predictions are exponentially sensitive to things like assumptions about the virus parameters, future government policy, and the community compliance, as you mentioned, Niyosh. But also in South Africa, for example, there's roughly a 5 to 10 day delay in test, in actually getting the results of tests. So basically, our testing is purely for epidemiological purposes. It's not helping in terms of tracing and quarantine, because you know people only find out 5 to 6 days later. It's not helpful. And I'll just make a point. So I think we definitely know that the IFR for COVID-19 is worse than flu. There's no evidence for any mitigating effects of weather or vaccine or blood type yet, but that could just be because we don't have good data. And then, you know, the thing that I'm thinking a lot about and have been for many weeks is, what is the right framework, optimization framework, for trying to decide, you know, what is the optimal policy going forward? Because you're having to blend all of this uncertainty together with the deaths that will follow from, come from COVID-19 versus the deaths that will come from TB or AIDS or HIV, or from just from people committing suicide because of depression or losing their jobs, you know, the suffering that the loss of jobs will create. So yeah, lots of difficult problems. I'll stop there. Thank you very much.
All right, thank you very much, Bruce. Let's see, so we're open for questions now. I don't see anything at the moment in the chat or anyone with a hand raised, but.
I just wanted to say that was the hardest opening to clap to. I don't know.
Thank you.
The hardest closing to clap to, I should say, yeah.
Yeah, exactly, absolutely. Yeah.
Maybe I can ask them. So for the climate analysis, what kind of data did you use?
I could have just done the whole seminar on this one point. So we used death data. And of course, if you look, for example, here's Israel. So what we did is we look, is there a correlation between growth rate and climate, for example? And here the growth rate is the growth rate, the daily growth rate in deaths. Well, we know that over time these growth rates change, right? They naturally, you have this phase, this turnover. So what are we actually asking, right? Well, I think we're asking about the initial phase when you're purely exponential and you haven't seen any effects. So we had to design a model for effectively just extracting that initial phase of the death rate. So that's what we did. And you can do that for many countries. But then the problem is, does that answer your question? Because I was just going to start rambling.
I wanted to know, like, how did the climate, is it temperature change in all of these countries and then fitting them?
Yes. So basically we have a hierarchical model that we built, which tries to say, okay, there's clearly a lot of variation in the average growth rates of these different countries. That could be due to density differences, cultural differences, all sorts of reasons. But now we ask, okay, if I just build a linear model where I say that I'm trying to predict this, these growth rates, as due to some intrinsic variability that is due to lots of factors that we don't control for, plus alpha times the temperature in each of those countries on average, and then compute the posterior distribution for alpha. And that's what this is, for example. So here's the posterior distribution for the coefficient for temperature. Zero would mean nothing, no effect. And you can see, there's several ways you can do it, but in both cases, we see something around 1.5 to 2 sigma evidence for temperature being relevant. But it's not a detection, right? But it is what you would expect. The warmer the country, the less the growth rate for death. And similarly with humidity.
What's the most significant thing you find?
The most significant thing we found was this one, the positive rate. So this is the positive fraction, what fraction of tests came back positive. So what we found is that countries that had a very high positive rate of tests also had the highest growth rate of deaths. That kind of makes sense, right? From a correlation point of view, but it's not, I don't think it's not necessarily causative. Look, a country like, or a city like New York, where the growth of deaths is very high, it's not surprising that their testing systems would be overwhelmed and they would record a very high positive rate of tests.
But did you find any other significant correlation? It looks like that's the only significant correlation you found, right?
Yeah, that was the only significant correlation.
John is asking a question, go ahead.
Bruce, I have a question.
Hi, John.
Thank you for your interesting, nice talk. The question is, how does COVID-19 compare to the 1918 flu epidemic, pandemic, and the 1968 flu epidemic? There were waves for the, I think there were three waves for the 1918 flu.
Absolutely. You know, John, I have never found any really in-depth analysis of the 1918 flu. That, I'm sure, doesn't mean it's not available, but, you know, so that's just a preface that what I'm going to say is very fluffy and not very useful. There were definitely three or more waves. And the second, and you know, the first wave was not the dangerous one. The second wave was the really deadly one. And even the number of people who died is, you know, the estimates are all over the place, including the estimates of the IFR. So I think the thing about the 1918 flu is that it warns us about the possibility of mutations. I, for example, don't even know why did it stop after 3 years, right? Why didn't it just become endemic for the next 25 years? So I think there's some very interesting questions around that. And I don't know. And the 1968, similar kind of questions, you know. There is, in all of this, there is the question, if COVID-19 had struck 50 years ago or 60 years ago, what would have happened? There's some small chance that, you know, we're blowing things out of proportion at some level, you know, that it will turn out to kill, you know, 2 million people, you know. I think it's a good question. I mean, I sent a mail, around the 22nd of January to a bunch of people in South Africa saying I thought that this was inevitably going to hit South Africa, and that if the Chinese kind of spread of the disease in China was maintained, then half the world would be infected by the middle of May. And you can see that, right? If you just keep this exponential growth going up, I mean, it just goes straight through the roof. I think it's just part of the fact how little we know in some sense.
Well, the one interesting thing about the 1980 flu historically is that there was a big military parade in Philadelphia, I think in June 1918. And 200,000 people turned up for the parade. And within days, there were many thousands of infections and consequent deaths.
Absolutely.
Whereas in Louisiana, they had a complete lockdown compared to Philadelphia. And there was a significant difference in what happened.
Absolutely.
So we have to worry about the...
absolutely.
Rally, the Trump rally that's going to happen next Saturday.
Well, I think it's interesting that the US is now daily infections are down at 1%, right? So maybe that's not the right statistic because the US is, you know, is effectively 50 small countries. So it would be better to look at the percentage increases. But there's no country. South Africa, unfortunately, 2 days ago was the country with the leading number percentage of new cases at about 5%. But you know, that's not bad. When you look at this, you know, the US initially was around 28% of per day. Now there's no country above this point, 5%. South Africa is at 5%. So, you know, there's been this remarkable migration into the slow growth rate. My concern with that is that the number of people who will die because they can't get to hospital. Like the problem is now, if you get sick in South Africa, for example, if you get sick, you know, there won't be ICU beds available. So the collateral deaths are, you know, there's very complicated optimization problems.
Okay, well, is that, dude, if unless I'm missing any further questions, let's thank Bruce again for a great talk, very stimulating.
Thank you so much.